5 in the box for Dundee United. In from Carson, here's a chance. What a good save by David Priest. Denies Billy Dodds his second Dundee United goal in his second spell at Tannadice.
Hello and welcome to the Goalkeepers Union podcast. Me, Matt Beadle, here with the voice of goalkeeping, Richard Lee.
Hello, Matthew.
Hello, Richard.
How are we today?
We are good. Excited about what's coming because we've secured a guest we've been after for a while. I feel like this has been a long time coming.
Yeah, one that certainly I was hugely excited by. So somebody that, again, I'm sure anybody that's on social media that follows goalkeeping in any capacity will have seen plenty of fantastic information being put out by this man, and somebody that I wanted to lock horns. Is that the right word?
I feel like that's right. I feel like you and this man are kind of one and the same, but slightly different.
Yeah.
Same, but different.
And obviously we've done the interview at this point, so I knew it was going to be a really interesting discussion because I've always felt that there's certain similarities in terms of how our mindset is towards goalkeeping and our thoughts on mindset and other bits and pieces as well. So this was one that I've been looking forward to for a really, really long time. And thankfully, it didn't disappoint. It very rarely does, but certainly this conversation, again, takes a very different path to others that we've had. Such a knowledgeable person, somebody who certainly I look up to and follow on social media and really appreciate his input. So to have the opportunity to discuss goalkeeping in depth with him was something that I've been really looking forward to.
Let's get into it, shall we? Over to David Priest. This week's guest is a goalkeeper who, just like this very podcast, has a lot to say about goalkeeping. Starting out in Sunderland, he enjoyed spells in Scotland, in Denmark and in Iceland. He's a writer, a broadcaster, a Twitter sensation and a drum banger for balanced goalkeeping analysis. Currently continuing his Scandinavian sojourn as goalkeeper coach of Swedish outfit Östersund's David Priest. Welcome to the Goalkeepers Union podcast.
Thanks for having me on. Real pleasure.
Great to have you on. I feel like we've been gearing up to this moment ever since we started this. You and Richard just going at it, hammer and tongs about goalkeeping.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that I've been wanting to do for a while, and you know, listen to podcasts and you know, trying to listen to a lot of anything that's to do with goalkeeping podcasts, and it's I think we're fighting the good fight, aren't we?
Absolutely. Well, I'm looking forward to getting into it. Before we do, we've got our three quick-fire questions to get ourselves going. The first of those is, which brand of gloves did you wear when you played?
Probably over the course of my career, probably there was two, Roush and Adidas, but I was a big Roush man.
Oh, yeah, the old Peter Schmeichel big Roush, yeah?
Yeah, I used to love it. I used to do like a Roush Aqua, which are like, just like plain white with a light blue arrow. Okay. You know, the old style. I was devastated when they changed that to, and they start developing a little bit more. I think sometimes, I don't know whether you found that, sometimes you found a glove that you really liked, and then all of a sudden, because they'd, you know, they're developing the technology and everything, they change it, and it was always a real struggle to try and get a pair of those, you know. But it's and then there was other times when I went to Denmark, the club had a contract with Old Sports. As I got older, I think you know, starting to realise it wasn't about the gloves, it's more what was in them that mattered.
Absolutely. But
Roush are my big favourites.
Do you know what I remember? For me, it was the Sondico SRGs or SMGs. They had the two, and that, I used to love those gloves, and similarly, yeah, discontinued them. I was devastated. The second of the quickfire questions, what was your favourite kit that you ever wore?
Favourite kit? I'd have to say in Denmark, it was a Hummel kit. It was basically all the goalkeepers' outfits were, you know, they had a lot of colours because there was a lot of change. You had to change all the time. So they had all white, all black, all green, all blue, all yellow. But basically what they were, the goalkeepers' outfits were just exactly the same as the outfield. And I love that, especially the black and the white ones, just plain black, plain white. A lot of the time when it was, I mean, Denmark, it does get very cold in Denmark in the winter, but as much as I could, I used to try and wear the short sleeve shirts. Oh, I used to love that. When I first started Sunderland was sponsored by Hummel. And there's a kit that I think maybe Southampton at the time, maybe Aston Villa. It was all like sort of like small arrows. I absolutely loved it. I've got a grey one somewhere that I really loved. I really like playing in grey, either grey and black. Really like that. I know there's a big thing about Levy Ashton, and I wasn't a big fan of the... I wore some horror kits in my time. I'm sure you have as well, like, you know, but it's, yeah, I wasn't a big fan of the big, bright, multicolored ones.
Do you know, that's really funny because we recorded another podcast recently with Paul Farman, the Carlisle United goalkeeper, and he was talking about his favourite kit being a bright pink one that he wore, cool pink, whatever it was. I can't remember how he described it, but it was a pink goalkeeper kit. And he said that he always preferred the brighter colours. But I remember hearing Neville Southall, that was something that he always used to say, wasn't it? That he preferred to wear a darker goalkeeper kit because he felt like it affected the striker or the attacker more because he was harder to make out. If a goalkeeper was wearing a bright goalkeeper shirt, it was a lot easier for the striker to make out.
Yeah, I'm sure there's like some sort of study or some theory behind the bright kits to make you to try and put the striker off to make you more obvious. But yeah, I was a bit more of that thought with Neville Southall. And I mean, I was a massive Neville Southall fan anyway, you know, anything that he used to say, that I used to hang on to every word. Yeah. And especially now, I mean, it's amazing what Neville Southall's become now, just on Twitter and in the general world. Because when I first started doing the you know, the goalkeeping stuff, I started following Neville, and then all of a sudden he started DMing me, disagreeing with what I was saying. Actually, you know, because sometimes I think I get accused of maybe being too lenient on goalkeepers, not being critical enough, and he would just DM me and just say, you know, say that he disagreed, and I was shocked at the time, you know, because this is Neville Southall, and I think, oh God, Neville Southall's disagreeing with me, you know, I must be everything I say must be terrible, like, you know, really took me hard, but he was really nice about it, you know, really nice about it, and like sort of like put it in a really nice way, and he's such a great fella, you know. It was amazing that, I mean, that's the power of Twitter. Twitter's been, it's obviously been brilliant for me. To bring me together with Neville Southall and discuss some goalkeeping, and especially like Jordan Pickford, because he was getting a lot of criticism as well. And yeah, it was just brilliant. I mean, I was overwhelmed by that.
We're definitely going to get into this in this podcast because
100%. Yeah.
That's well. I'll ask the.
I was going to say, I almost want to brush past the quick fires, but we'll do it. We'll do the last
one. We'll do the not so quick fire questions. The last one is: what was your favorite ever save? Not necessarily the most memorable, but your favorite ever save that you made.
There's one that when I was in Denmark, we were playing Bromby away, and I think we were winning 1-0. And it was about 2 minutes from time. Ball came in the box, it was bobbling around a little bit, and just made a bit of a double save. There was one low down to my right that just come out of nowhere, reflex save down low. The ball's popped up again into the air, and it's kind of like popped up in just above the line. And then one of the centre halves is just coming in, and he's just going to head the ball to the net, and I sort of managed to get back up again and just tip it away from him on the line. And it was like, it's the one save that really always sticks out in my head, and probably one of the only ones that I've got any footage of as well. A bit like yourself, you know, it wasn't 4K footage when we were playing there.
Well, in many cases, David, I often feel like sometimes I don't really need to say much and just let Rich and the guest chew the fat on some of the podcasts that we do. And I'm guessing that might be the same here. And you've just spoken about Neville Southall there and Twitter. And just take us back, really, to when you first started exposing the lack of goalkeeping analysis and just how you started. I mean, I said a Twitter sensation at the beginning. I don't think that's I don't think that's inaccurate. I think, you know, you're nearly on 40,000 followers now. You speak about goalkeeping a lot and you've really developed a reputation for yourself. When did it start for you, this new wave of goalkeeping analysis?
Probably going back to about 2012-2013. At that point, I'd just left Barnsley, I think, and I'd been doing a degree with the PFA, professional sports writing and broadcasting. And that was all something that I'd been interested in, especially when I went to Scotland, got a few injuries, spent a little bit of time out. And I always had this thought that I wanted to be a writer or a journalist. I used to write a lot just for myself from a very young age. You know, I think I've said this somewhere before, that I picked up one of my dad's Reader's Digest when I was younger. And I always had trouble sleeping. I probably only sleep now because I'm old and I'm tired. That's why I say, you know, but I've been a bit of a night owl all my life. And I remember reading something really young, I'm saying that to help you sleep at night time, just write something down. And that's really how it started. And that was at a really young age. I mean, I was probably about 8 or 9 years old or something like that. And I remember sitting up sort of in my bed, and I'd be under my duvet and I'd have a little torch and I'd be writing down what I was thinking and things like that. And that just developed. So, and that was a thing that I carried through all my career. You know, I maybe go through periods where I didn't do that, but especially when I started playing, and then you're going through, when you're going through bad periods, you know, you feel like you lost a little bit of form. And then I sort of started just writing training journals, how I felt about training, what I did in training. I've got books everywhere, you know, probably in a garage somewhere, where it's just full of my thoughts and what I was thinking at the time, and it really helped me, and that sort of developed into, as I got older in my teenage years, I just write stories and things like that. So that's how that side of it began. And then when I got to, you know, around that time, I started working with James Brown, who's he was the editor and founder of Loaded magazine. And he sort of started following me on Twitter, and through a mutual friend, Andy Gray, who used to play for, he played for Leeds, Sheffield United, Sunderland, and I played with him at Barnsley. And through him, I sort of met James. James sort of said, oh, I really like your stuff on Twitter. And then this is like, well, mate, I probably didn't have any followers at that time. I was just putting out stupid things that popped into my head. And he says, oh, I really like the stuff you put on Twitter. Tell him to give us a ring if he wants to do some writing, blah, blah, blah. And then it just followed from there. And then at that time, I was going down to London working with him on my days off in his office. He had a website called Sabotage Times. So he taught me how to edit the site. You know, I was writing little bits for him. But then I was writing about everything. I was writing about, I'm a big fan of Danish design furniture, mid-century design furniture, chairs especially. So I was writing about that. I was writing about fashion for the Top Man website. I was doing like a bit of a column where I'd be interviewing Raheem Sterling, you know, about, you know, the clothes he wore. I talk about the fashion that managers, you know, what managers used to wear, their coats. This is around the time when Jose Mourinho was wearing all these lovely Hugo Boss coats and everything. Yeah, and it was kind of like, you know, I knew a lot about that, but there's probably people who knew more about the music, you know, writing about everything with a football angle, sort of like what's, you know, music and dressing room things. Like that. But I always thought that there's people who know more about music than I do. There's people who know more about fashion. So what do I do? Write about something that you know about, and then that was it. It was just goalkeeping. One day I was sitting watching the TV on a Sunday, and it was, you know, I can't remember who the commentator was, but the words were, the goalkeeper should have done better there. And then it just sort of struck something inside me, and it was like. So I tweeted about it. Yeah, from then on, it was kind of like, it just thing went off my head saying, this isn't good enough. You know, we don't have anything about goalkeeping. And that's sort of, that started opening up. And I was writing for websites for free or for 20 quid for a PC. And I started working for a website called UMaxit, just writing for them, writing little pieces. And that's where my first piece about goalkeeping analysis that came out, and it's just sort of like snowballed from there, really.
Yeah, I mean, it's mad that you did actually just do regular journalism, and then eventually you naturally went in to goalkeeping. And I mean, you're not unfamiliar with podcasts as well, right? You also had your own a couple of years ago, the number one podcast.
Yeah, we did, and that sort of it was brilliant at the time. We probably did that, I don't know, about 6 to 9 months or something like that, with Lloyd Griffith. And who's, you know, he's a goalkeeper, probably a goalkeeper first, comedian second. That's what he sees himself, you know. But he's, he got in contact through a mutual friend, and we started that. And it was, and that was the aim as well. We didn't really know how it was going to develop, but we just thought we'll start one and we'll see how it goes, and try to, obviously with Lloyd being there, try to bring a bit of humour into it as well. And then unfortunately it was. I think this was like just before I'd moved to Sweden, probably about 2018. I'd moved to Sweden. Lloyd was going on a tour with him by himself around the country, and then he was joining Jack Whitehall, supporting him. So then we just put it on the back burner, and then obviously I've been in Sweden 2 years now. Yeah, it's never really picked up again. But yeah, you know, podcast has been one of the great things for me, especially, you know, people like the Totally Football Show. Give me a great platform to speak and sort of project what I want about goalkeeping.
You made a comment earlier that we're fighting the good fight, which we We are. I mean, it's, you made a couple of comments there about the thing that kind of boiled your blood to an extent and you had to say something, then it's built from there. Do you think now, since that moment in whatever it was, 2012-13, when you started and you first started commenting on bits and pieces that were being said, do you think there's been enough of an improvement in that? And I say this, and it's, I suppose, a slightly loaded question, because I'm watching the game yesterday as of recording. It was West Brom away at Wolves, and again, it's on BT, and they're going to the referee every few minutes to get their thoughts on a refereeing decision. But again, the still at this moment isn't, as much as there are more ex-goalkeepers that are gradually getting involved, they still don't have that where they go to that goalkeeping specialist to talk about a goalkeeping moment. Do you think it's getting there? Do you think it's progressing in the right way?
It is, and it's something I've spoke about with people, with producers at Sky and BT. This was, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, and that really was the idea. And it was obviously, I mean, part of it was for myself, thinking that, you know, it was something that I could do and sort of offer my service. But and at the same time, I know that I'm not a high profile name. You know, I didn't play Premier League. I spent one season on the bench when Sunderland got there in '97. And that's about as much as I got in the Premier League. So it was, and I know that I'm not high profile. I'm not, you know, people that they have on now, like, you know, Rob Green. I think Rob Green's terrific. Maybe he only started doing it the last couple of seasons since he stopped playing. And I think his commentary is very good. I think his analysis is very good. And especially with times when something happened with keepers, you know, he's been absolutely spot on with what he says and putting the goalkeeper side. And, you know, I do think that we need more of that. And I, the space, that, especially on BT Sport and Sky Sports now, when they're showing so much football and there's so much room in between games and before and after, that there is space for that. You know, there is space for somebody to come in and add their comments, because you see it now that there's so much scrutiny of football. You're right what you said about the referees. It's probably the only position now where it's not covered. And I think that... there is more goalkeepers, you're right, in the media and doing maybe it's not analysis, but general analysis. Mm. There is a room for somebody who can provide that key analysis that goes beyond just you should do better or that's bad goalkeeping. Because a lot of the time, I think, you know, you've seen it as well. When I think I can't remember who it was the other week. It was a Crystal Palace game. It was Guaita. Mm. I can't remember who shot against him, but it was like it was a shot from distance, and it's moved a lot.
Yeah.
It just starts to go to his right, moves to his left, and it kind of just—it's like in playing cricket when the ball hits the seam and it comes off the seam, and it just moved away from him. And by that time, he shifted his body weight to his right, and he just can't recover the other side.
Yeah.
And he gets hammered by the commentators. He gets hammered by everyone on Twitter. It's like there needs to be some nuance here. It's not a case of just, oh, he should save that. You've got to say that, you know, you look at the shot. That shot, he said, yeah, you can see it all the way. Yeah, you can see it all the way, but he probably doesn't start changing direction until it gets about 8 or 6 yards before him. And by that time, the way the ball's travelling, it's too late to change. And it there's no understanding about that. I know that through my media work, that in newspapers and TV, people don't just want what's straight down the middle and the truth. They want, it's either really good or really bad. That's what makes, you know, the sensationalized of everything. Where I think that there's something in between where it can give a lot of understanding, especially the way we talk about football now. So much detail goes into football. You know, you see lots of data analysis. You know, everyone's given the tactical analysis on Twitter. You know, you've got a big platform in the TV. Give them real understanding. Educate people about it. So then we can stop this. And then people for themselves, maybe in the future they don't need telling because they can see it for themselves.
Well, I mean, I agree entirely. That example, actually, and this was, and it's a great example, because I always ask the question whether there's a danger to the sensationalist approach in that, you know, that game in particular, he almost went from villain to hero, because, of course, then he makes some fantastic saves second half, and that was the narrative for that game. But you're right, that example there, where I've watched it and straight away, I watched a lot of games on mute. I'd watched it and straight away I'm like, he's got no chance. They've seen it behind. I'm like, please, come on, someone must pick up on that. And no one does. And then you've got the 3 or 4 pundits afterwards, all ex-outfield players, that are trying to dissect it. And it's nothing against them from my point of view, because they're just doing their job. They're asked to dissect what's happened. But again, it's effectively a different sport. And I guess this is the point that we make a lot on here, is that it must be so difficult. It'd be the same for me, vice versa. Like, I, you know, as much as I've got an opinion on outfield players, on a striker, whether a striker should do better, again, it's something I've never necessarily done. So it is that little bit more difficult. I mean, that Guaita one, great example, because I said, had that taken a deflection 8 yards from him, then do we blame him? And everyone's like, well, no, of course not. Well, that's effectively what's happened. As you said, he's gone one way. It's effectively deflected back across him. But it's just the fact that it doesn't look good, which so many goals you see now, they won't look good. And straight away, the goalkeeper will perhaps look a little bit silly because of the movement on the ball or whatever it might be. And then instantly, of course, the natural reaction is, the keeper should do better. And that's the quote, isn't it? The keeper should do better. But there isn't the explanation to back up what exactly they should have done in order for it to be better. But I guess then that goes back to what you said before, in that if we do want this sensationalist approach, then perhaps it won't come in anytime soon. Because, you know, effectively, if it was yourself on there just talking sense and breaking it down logically and explaining why a mistake's happened, that isn't necessarily that interesting to the viewer.
Perhaps not, but I think there's enough people out there who want the knowledge, who want to know that, you know. And I think that I look at the way the cricket's covered, and see that in, I know that maybe have a lot more space in between, or when if they're having a break for lunch or for tea, you know, they go to somebody like Robert Key, and they'll go somewhere in the nets at wherever the England team's playing, and he'll take one of the commentators or bring a guest in. And then they'll talk about specifics of batting, and they'll go through all the mechanics of it all and how it happens. And, you know, that something that happens in milliseconds, they break it down so that, you know, that to give you a great understanding. And that's what I love about it. I think that's why with goalkeeping, there's such a cry for more detail, because that's what we're about. We're about the details. The tiniest details make huge differences in goalkeeping because of the consequences. And I think that goalkeepers ourselves, and, you know, I've read a lot of your stuff. I know your background and sort of like your time at Watford and Brentford. And I make a big connection with everything that you say and the way that you look at things, because we're natural analysts, not only just before and after the game, but during the game. And I know sometimes it's a bit of a, you shouldn't be thinking about things in the game. If you're in the flow and you're in the game, then things happen naturally and you're not thinking about things, and you know what it's like, the game goes quickly. A lot of times you do get the breaks in play and you do get a chance to think about things, not only about your own performance, but about what's happening in front of you. And I think that, you know, you look at the one-to-one coaching that you have, a goalkeeping coach, you have more time there to talk about situations, and that's just a massive part of being a goalkeeper, I think, and the details really matter. And I think now you see it in the goalkeeping community, especially on social media, it's huge. You know, whether it's sort of the likes of me and yourself who are, you know, talking about things from our experience as well, or you go to Instagram, you see all these people doing ridiculous things, you know, diving on the beach and into the water on the beach or whatever. And I know people, I've criticised that myself as well. I've criticised in the past because it's a lot of it's so far away from what the actuality of professional goalkeeping is. But I've taught myself around to it. I know that all this stuff that's on Instagram and whatever, it's getting kids engaged with goalkeeping. It's making goalkeeping sexy for people. So if a young kid sees, I'm trying to think of, maybe modern day goalkeeper. The modern day goalkeeper, yeah. You know, people like that, Lee Robinson and his brothers who do that. You know, initially a lot of that was to do with, you know, this his side volley. He's got brilliant side volleys. He's got a great foot on him. And there's a lot of like little snaps on Instagram and they grew huge. And that's great because, like I said, it gets kids engaged into it. And maybe all the other accounts, you know, like I talk about, the, you know, people doing stuff on the beach and using forward rolls, somersaults and everything like that. It's not for me. So it doesn't mean that it's wrong. You know, so it's great that it gets people engaged. And I think that because it's so broad now, people want to be goalkeepers. Kids want to be goalkeepers now. there is a sort of bit of an X factor to it as well. Yeah, so the huge community that there is on social media, that there is a sort of there's a desire for detail, and that's what we can give them.
Do you know what you know? You're spot on, and I think that when I mentioned earlier about the danger to a lot of the pundits that we hear, the danger for me was that in that if you're a kid watching it, would you want to be a goalkeeper? Because 9 times out of 10, the goalkeeper is getting criticised as opposed to getting praised, and even when they're doing positive things, you know, people are still dissecting it, not necessarily giving the praise that maybe a goalkeeper deserves. So I'm thinking from that point of view, if you're a kid watching, you're not necessarily going to want to be a goalkeeper. However, I agree entirely with what you say. As much as, you know, some of the crazy things you do see where they are jumping over barrels, jumping over hurdles, doing this, that, the other, and never going to make someone a better goalkeeper. I can imagine as an 8, 9, 10 year old goalkeeper, you're watching that, or an 8, 9, 10 year old kid, you're watching that thinking that's fun. Like, I want to do that form of training, which can only then be a good thing. So yeah, I'm certainly with you on that. The other bit that I wanted to touch on was you mentioned about goalkeepers being quite analytical, and you know, I think we certainly share that. And I give this example where you're stood there, you're behind your team, and the amount of things that are going on in any given moment, you know, people always say after a game, if you haven't had a shot to save, you'll get the classic comment of, oh, it was a quiet one for you today. But not considering that actually the amount of concentration that will go into a top goalkeeper's game, where you're forever considering where your defenders are in front of you, where the ball is, where your positioning should be according to where the ball is it in swing or out swing, or what are the conditions, is it going to zip through, is it going to hold, you know, all these questions that you're constantly asking yourself. So then, which effectively then goes back to the point we're making, that it is different. It's different. We are different animals to the outfield players. More often, quite different personalities as well, because you do, I find, need to be quite an analytical character because of the nature of the position.
Yeah, of course you do. And I think that's, you know, I know you've spoken in the past about sort of the mental side of the game, and sort of sometimes it can be a real struggle, you know, especially when you're younger. I think, looking back now, you don't realise actually how mentally strong you were, because I think that, you know, overthinking can be a bad thing as well, you know, and I was, you know, guilty of that a lot. You know, sometimes you can think too much into things, and sometimes I'm quite jealous of goalkeepers who you meet who are just sort of like a bit very tunnel vision. I always thought that Jordan Pickford was a bit like that, especially earlier on, where he was kind of like, as he progressed up, it was like he was just not ignorant, but he was just sort of oblivious to what was going on around him. And obviously now he's at a point where it's impossible to do that because of the focus, because of the level he's playing at. But it's kind of like, I wish I could just sort of just focus on the game and not be thinking about the million of things that are happening in it. But at the same time, it's like a bit of a, you know, as much of a curse as a gift as well. Like, you know, I think it's good to be analytical like that.
I was reading a couple of things that you'd said over the years as well, David, and I think one of those was the fact that you said you went to Denmark and the blinkers came off you with regards to your view to football, and you've got to take in ideas from everywhere. The same ideas don't work for every goalkeeper, and I guess that fits into what we're discussing now, because one of the key things for me when we do this podcast is balance. And you said about being a bit too lenient with goalkeepers. And I think that it's okay to criticise goalkeepers. That's not a bad thing, as long as you're doing it with a decent opinion to go with that. And I think you mentioned there about Twitter. One of the things I've experienced, I think, from doing this is that you can have an opinion on Twitter and you might talk about goalkeeping or those videos that you're saying of people on the beach or throwing tennis balls or jumping over hurdles. Sometimes the responses that you get with those tweets, with those videos, that's an absolute disgrace. You shouldn't be doing that. It's absolutely outrageous. Similarly, if you have an opinion on something that's happened in goalkeeping, you're wrong. You don't know about goalkeeping. That's absolutely incorrect. Okay, well, it's fine that you can have that opinion. I get that, but let's debate it. Try and articulate yourself better. So now we can have a constructive debate about goalkeeping. I also feel that sometimes there are even goalkeeping accounts out there on Twitter that almost go at each other rather than saying, do you know what, we're all, like you said, fighting the same fight here, let's work together and actually get the message across.
Yeah, I mean, I'm probably guilty of sometimes of being a little bit too defensive, not all the time, but just on occasions. I mean, we're all the same, you know, depending on what mood we are when we're sitting with our phone in our hand, you know, I can be a bit quick to sort of try and put people down a little bit if I don't think that they're coming from in the right way. And sometimes you do get a lot of aggressive responses anyway, so you want to be aggressive back to them, you know. That's just the nature of the beast. But I think it's right what you say, you know, that when you're at the start of there, balance. Everything's about balance, and it's something that's key in the way that I look at coaching. It's not about just doing one thing for one person or looking at things one way. You're right to us again about the Denmark quote, because it is about being adaptable, and that's one thing I've really learned. It's about being adaptable. You've got to be able to in the coaching aspect. You know, sometimes, you know, when I'm coaching, I've been coached the last few years. Sometimes I'll have three keepers. I know I'm on three keepers. I've designed my session, and then one of them's pulled out for one reason or another, whether or another feeling something, or the sports sciences, or, you know, they've been overloaded. We need to deload them today. So you've got to be adaptable. And I think that over the course of everything, that's, you know, it is about being really balanced about it. And that's in everything. I don't mean just in people's opinions, but in the way that you look at goalkeeping and the way that you look at things. Because before I went to Denmark, you're right, I had blinkers on. I thought that this is how I see football, and if I'm going to become a coach or a manager, this is how I'm going to do things. I went to Denmark and it just blew everything away. Especially when I had a year at Odense, and goalkeeping coach there, Tom Sturrowell. I didn't play at all that season. I was on the bench all year. They came second in the league, did fantastic. Arik Anoshko, first choice keeper, was brilliant that season. And but I learned a hell of a lot. It was so worth going there, even though I didn't play, because of the train that I had under Tom Sturrowell. And he was right up my street. At that, you know, at that point in my career, I was probably about 32. I was all about the details, and the fine details he went into, especially in technical stuff. It just blew my mind. And I think that's something that I've carried on. And it's not about, you know, I think we're, especially with coaches on Twitter, we're a bit sort of quick there, maybe not criticised, but it's kind of like, if it's not their way, then it's not the right way. But again, like I said, it's not, you know, not everybody is in the same situation. So I spoke to a few coaches, and, you know, lately about, you know, we see a lot of sessions where, you know, there'll be coaches who have four goalkeepers to work with. They'll have an assistant or two assistants working with them. So you've got seven bodies there. You could do a million things with seven bodies, a million things. But the truth of it is, maybe it's only at the very top level, have you got that luxury of being able to build sessions with that many bodies? And I think sometimes when we see things with goalkeepers where they're doing drills, where it's just one goalkeeper, like a one-on-one, or maybe it's only two goalkeepers, where you're a little bit restricted to what you can do. That's probably more the reality of goalkeeping coaching for 99% of goalkeeping coaches. Yeah, I think there's room for everything. Over the years, I probably saw that I've been very critical of people, you know, oh, I definitely wouldn't do this. That's what, you know, you shouldn't do that. Well, like I said, with the YouTube stuff, okay, that's right for one person, that might be right for the other. That's the way they see it. And as long as they believe in their philosophy, then it's fine.
Did you always see that you were going to eventually migrate into coaching, David? I know you worked at Lincoln, and you had a spell at Manchester City as well.
Yeah, I probably coached all the way through my career, especially when I first went to Aberdeen. We used to take a session with the goalkeepers every Thursday night, and that's where I did my first goalkeeping qualification. I think I'm right in saying that the Scottish FA were the first association to have a UEFA qualification. I might be wrong about that, but anyway, it was about 2004 while I was at Aberdeen, so I was probably about 28 at the time. That's why I took my first goalkeeping qualification up there. So then when I went to Denmark, I followed that on as well. Used to, you know, quite often take some of the youth team goalkeepers there, or the academy goalkeepers there. And it was something that I really enjoyed. And the older I got, like, and when I came back and went to Barnsley, started doing my degree, and then it was kind of like, I didn't know what I was going to do. Was I going to go to journalism? I actually wanted to go into advertising. The work that I did with James, I was going into a place like Freud's, B&B, all these big advertising agencies. And that really struck a chord with me as well. Really struck a chord with me. I saw myself maybe going into there. I was, you know, applying for a couple of jobs. I had a couple of interviews with people. I really toyed with the idea, and then the opportunity came up when I left Barnsley. I went to Portsmouth for a little bit, sort of like just training with them. Went away at the Gibraltar training camp, and then came back. And then David Holdsworth offered me the player goalkeeping coach's role at Lincoln. So that's where it really started at that level. I went to Barnsley for a little bit, back to Barnsley, working with the 18s and 23s. And then I had a little bit of a break. My daughter was living in Barnsley at the time when I was working there. Then her and her mother moved up to Newcastle. So then it was like, then life sort of intervened. And it was kind of like, I need my weekends to see my daughter. I need to go to Newcastle to see my daughter. So I just thought, I'll take 6 months break. I'll do media work, see how that goes. And that 6 months turned into a year, turned into 18 months. And things started to take off a little bit. I was working a lot, like we talked about before, about Talk Sport, getting stuff for Five Live, writing for the Times and other papers, Sunderland Echo, I had a column there. And I was quite happy doing that. But I always felt there was something missing. You know, it was the closest thing I could get to like the buzz of playing was doing live stuff, was doing live shows, whether it was the football Friday Live with Joe. We used to do that. That was broadcast live, all the radio stuff. That was the real buzz for me, live radio. The buzz was being on radio and not messing up. And that was the same feeling that I got when I was playing. Yeah. You know, yeah, that was, it wasn't until afterwards that I realised that was the drug. You know, however your motivation is, my motivation a lot of time was fear of failure. That's what drove me a lot of the time. And I'm probably thankful for that because I probably wasn't as good as a lot of people. A lot of players that I played with, I probably wasn't as gifted as them. But because that fear of failure that drove me, I was, you know, it meant that I was working 100% every day. And that's what pushed me on. And then, yeah, so, and then I got a call from David Rouse in Manchester City. Xabi Mancisidor was setting up his own sort of department. He was taking away the recruitment from the scouting system that they already had, from their own recruitment. And then he was sort of bringing it into sort of under his jurisdiction. So at the time, there was David Rouse was head of recruitment, and then there was myself and Joe Corrigan who were working with him. And I really enjoyed that. I loved it. You know, I was going watching goalkeepers at under nine level, traveling to across to Holland to watch a lot of the under 15s, under 14s keepers at Ajax and AZ Alkmaar, and then also I was putting reports in on Zach Steffen, who signed for them eventually. He's number two there now, and I really like that, you know, because it sort of married the two together. I was involved in football as well, but I was still doing the analysis, you know. I was analysing the keepers that were already there at City, you know, giving my opinion on them, putting reports in on them. And like I said, different targets up and down the country and in Europe. And I really loved that. Really, really loved it because it married the two together. Yeah, and then I got a call from Ian Birchall. We met a couple of years previously through a guy, Stefan Erneman, who I played with in Denmark. He was visiting Ian here in England. He says, "Why don't you come and have dinner with us?" And then that's where the friendship with Ian Birchall came from. And she got a call one Saturday night asking if I'd be interested in going over. And then 2 years later, I'm still at Ostersund.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It's interesting hearing the journey. I really want to dig into your philosophy when it comes to goalkeeper coaching and what you try and do. Before that, just to touch on some of the stuff at City. You mentioned David Rouse. We had him on the podcast actually recently. Really good podcast that we did with Rousey again. So many different experiences. That Zach Steffen one is fascinating, where it sounds again another one where our paths may have crossed, because I was heavily recommending him to Bristol City at the time as well. It might have been a very, very similar time. And he, for me, I'd love to get your thoughts on him as a goalkeeper, because he's obviously just started to break through now, played a couple of games for City this season. For me, looked very, very impressive in the games he's played. And you look at him as a package, the shape of him, the way in which he moves, his distribution, etc., etc. He looks like a goalkeeper that could really make a name for himself over here.
Yeah, I think so. And he's very much in the mould of what City are after. You know, the template is Edison. You know, and lucky to see a few sessions, and Xabi is quite secretive about his work. You know, he doesn't really let a lot of people watch the way he works. But you look at Edison, and just what's incredible about him is just his whatever his technical abilities are, his strength is his head.
Yeah,
how calm he is. He's just so placid in everything that he does. I absolutely ice cold. Yeah, like I said, he's the template, and I know that putting the report in on Zach, he was Xabi was loved him, absolutely loved him, and it was more of a case of just, I think it was myself, Rousey, and Xabi had looked at him, and it was kind of like, just, you know, Xabi loves him, he just needs confirmation from us two, really, yeah. You know, and watching him at Columbus Crew, he was. He had a really good the season that I watched him. He had an unbelievable season. Very good with the ball, his feet. You know, real good presence, and he was brilliant that season. It was a shame. I think he had the knee injury last year that they were wondering where they were going to put him when they first came over. Whether it was going to be Girona, where whether put one of them clubs where that's in the City Group where he can have a year there, transition to sort of European football, see what level he's at, and then bring him to City. And you're right, what you say about him. You look at him now, and he's, I think the one thing when a new goalkeeper comes in from playing in a different league, especially from MLS, it's about how they adapt. And it can take, for me, I think goalkeepers take longer to adapt. See, people are making mistakes on their debuts and that because, and I've wrote about this before, I think it's about familiarity a lot of time. It's about that relationship with your players. It's about your new surroundings, playing in new stadiums. I think that affects you because of the perception of why you're playing. If you've been playing somewhere a long time, I think you get comfortable, you get to know everything, you get to know the crowds, you get to know the stadiums. How they play, what the weather's like, and I think that's a big thing. When you play at Oakwell, that the at Barnsley, that the wind's going to be whistling through from one of the sides of the stadium, so you prepare for that. And all these little things make a big difference, I think. Yeah, so it was, and then to see him integrate so well, it can be easier when you're playing the team that's going to dominate possession, dominate games. Yeah, it can be that. But you still have to be there when you're needed. And I think that the fact that been quite seamless, there's been no bumps in the games that he's played, and he's looked a real part of it. And I think that that shows through in his mentality and in the way that he approaches things as well. And it's a great base to build on in the future. Where, there might be times when Edison's injured long term and he needs to come in. I think they've got a very good keeper ready to come in there.
Absolutely. Just to touch on the City youth system as well, because we've seen for years sort of Chelsea have always done it reasonably well in that they have loaned players out. I say well, there's a couple of parts to this. I've sometimes questioned as to the type of contracts that are being given at young ages at Chelsea. But in fairness to them, they're getting their keepers out on loan. I think even now, at time of this recording, I believe there's three that they've got in Nathan Baxter, Jamie Cummings, and one other that will come to me in a second. Blackman, of course, at Rotherham as well. So they've always got their younger keepers out on loan playing at good levels. And City now seemingly are doing a very similar thing. Like, there's a real glut of very good goalkeepers that they seem to have sort of age 17 to 20 or so. Is it Bazuna at Rochdale who's doing very well? You've got, obviously, James Trafford, I'm hearing lots of good things about. Louis Moulden's been there for a few years now as well. And so much focus. I don't really know of any other team that's put that much attention. I know, like, Bournemouth have got a very good goalkeeping department, and there's a few others that are highlighted for being quite positive. But from what he was saying, it sounded like that much attention going into the youth system and actually looking to produce your own goalkeepers, which certainly, God, if you got one that made it through to being in amongst it at a Man City, then instantly from a financial perspective as well, they're going to be worth a fortune.
Yeah, and that's it. And I know people criticise that Chelsea and Man City really have the same model now where the academies are paying for themselves and also, well, more than paying for themselves. And so I can't be critical of that if they are producing very good footballers and goalkeepers and then they're going on to have great careers. You can't really criticise that, whether it's a money-making machine or not. But I think, I think you're totally right. If the money's there to do it, then the specialised goalkeeping department in that area, in analysts, scouts, and obviously the coaches as well, overlooked by all. Xabi was interested in everything that was done, and all the keepers that were brought in, he always looked at them as well. And I think that's really important, And that's one thing that over the last couple of years been working on. Everything has to have a thread all the way through it from the very top, no matter what you're doing. There has to be a flow from top to bottom where it's all aligned. There's a theme or a wholeness or a something at the top that brings it all together. And I think Xabi did that. Everything was under his sort of philosophy and methodology. And that's really important for the long term, because then you're getting, you know, like I said before, if Edison's the template, then that's what you want aligned all the way down.
It sounds like an easy point to make this, David, but Xavi there, is he kind of like the Pep Guardiola of coaching, but for goalkeeping?
Yeah, I mean, a few conversations with Xabi, not a lot, because a lot of time, like I said, a lot of time I was probably only reporting back to City every once a month or something, and going to see Rousey and just checking in, and so I was away most of the time watching games and watching keepers from. But the few times that I had conversations with Xabi, it was really good, because I was he does see things a different way, you know, and I think a lot of people that have spoken to him or worked with him sometimes can say that about his ideas that they're a little bit different or that something that they wouldn't take on. But like I said before, like it was again a real eye opener just talking to him. I remember the first time I went there, just watching some of the academy teams training, and he was training a couple of the under 18 goalkeepers, and he'd just come over in between little things. He'd come over and chat, and he'd ask questions about what I thought about this. And there was a big thing about I don't know if you know about the wide stance that he has goalkeepers doing from an angle. So like when keepers go on an angle, they really have a real wide stance, because it's anything low that they'll go with their feet, and just to make sure that everything's covered. There's a lot more behind that, of course there is. But I remember saying to him, so-and-so's got a wide stance. And then he'd go through, and then he'd just take a few cones, and then he'd just go through it all and blah, blah, blah. And this is the way that I do it. And I love that, because a big thing for me, especially life going back from wanting to be a goalkeeper, it's about being different. And not being different for the sake of being different, but it's just trying to, whatever's the norm, that looking straight down the middle, that you look either side of that to see if you can make things better or tweak things and be a little different. And I love keepers and goalkeeping coaches who, like I said, are different but effective as well. And Xabi's definitely that. And you can compare him to Pep. I know that Pep wasn't the one that brought him in. He came in through Pellegrini. But you just look at his background with Malaga and Real Madrid and now with City. I think he's just a phenomenal character and really interesting guy as well.
Trapped again, and Forlan, and it's a good save from Priest. It's a good effort from Alejandro Forlan, with Pellicori sniffing around for any rebounds, and the Barnsley goalkeeper did well there.
That brings on quite nicely, because I want to talk about your philosophy now that you're doing what you're doing. You've made a few really interesting points there. The idea being that if you're putting on sessions, having a real idea to what you're asking the goalkeeper to do. So it's not just like anybody can go and put on a training session and volley a few balls at keepers, half volley them, get them to do some pickups, dives, etc. And they'll come away having got a good sweat on and feeling like they've worked, but not necessarily either stretching the comfort zones or understanding why they're doing what they're doing. Are you quite firm with the goalkeepers that you work with? Is it as much based on the field as what you'll do away from it, going through footage? Like, are you quite, I suppose, analytical in that way with the goalkeepers that you work with? What is your philosophy?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, we're lucky that at Ossesund's end that we have a camera system called Spideo. And that, so we train on 4G. We half the teams in Sweden play on 4G. So we get a train on there. At the stadium. So we have a camera system called Spideo. So you have a camera behind each goal and one from, I think it's two cameras from the side. So like a half level from the pitch and then like a tactical camera from the roof. And it's brilliant because you can switch between each camera, you can zoom in. It's unbelievable. So it's a really good tool to use. So when it comes to analysing goalkeepers, whether it's from the games, we have access to other teams' Spideo during match day, so we can use it in away games as well. But especially for training, it's a really good tool to use to go back, because we obviously, when we come in from training, we'll have lunch and then we go through the training session. We all look through the training session together. And I'll look at my little bits later on. But for me, I want the goalkeepers to be used as much as possible in the training session, whatever it is. And I think it was great when we have a manager now, Amir Zrafshan. You know, he gives me good a lot of freedom and a lot of input into what I, you know, what the training session is going to be. But Ian Birchinall, especially, who took me to Östersund while I worked on it, it was absolutely brilliant because when I went in there, I didn't have to ask him to introduce the goalkeepers into the, you know, to integrate them into the to the training session. You know, he was always asking, what can we do with keepers here? Can we bring the keepers in? So any sort of session that they were doing, he would always have the keepers in mind that can we fit them into, you know, is it a realistic match situation for them that they'll benefit from? And it was always for me, it's about decision making. Goalkeeping is about decision making, but also about balance. So there is room to do, for me, there is room to do the conscious technical stuff that is maybe is easy. But it's also about transferring that and making sure that they're using those techniques when they're playing and they make and using the decision making process. When I first started coaching a long time ago, it was a very much technical based, you know, like a little bit like everyone else. And because of the stuff that I'd learned in Denmark and then I transferred, you know, you mentioned Paul Farman before. I worked for with Farms for 2.5 years. A lot of stuff we did was technical stuff and trying to change little things that he was doing and but also building on the strengths that he already had. I think that's really important as well. And I think that as I've developed the last couple of, especially the last couple of seasons, working with similar goalkeepers, we have, obviously, again, the recruitment has to be right, and the recruitment under Graham Potter was unbelievable. You know, his scouting system was unbelievable. And there was three goalkeepers when I first came in, Ali Cater, Sixten Moline, and Andrew Mills. And they were all different in their own ways, but they were, again, there was a thread going through them, what was good about them. So that when if there was a change in goalkeeper in the game, then it wasn't a huge change. We'd have to change the way that it played. All keepers very good with their feet, all very good 1v1 situations, all very good, comfortable defending the space in front of the box because we were playing a high line. All these things they were very good at. So it was brilliant when I came in that it was a case of just trying to develop them and seeing any little things that I saw that they were doing wrong. And I say doing wrong, anything that was affecting them negatively in training and games that I could tweak as well. And like I said, you said before about balance, it's about balance and everything. And I'm a big believer in giving, how to put this, it's giving the solutions to what the game asks you. So a lot of the time, especially first team level, and especially this season, when we've had a condensed season, there's been very little training. It's all been about games. It's about what's required of you in games, what's required of you so that the before games and the training before games and the leading up to games, it's about what can we expect in the game coming up? What will you need to do in the game coming up? Can we try and see, you know, by me analysing the opposition, can I plan a session which gives you the situation which you'll face on Saturday? And then from there, it's, you know, 1v1 and the little things that we can do that can tweak games. Goalkeepers will work on that as well. But, you know, I look at some Ali Cater, he's been our number one for 2 years, probably been the consistently the best goalkeeper in the division. You know, he's been brilliant to work with. And a lot of the way that he plays, a lot of his techniques are not techniques that you would coach. They're not techniques that, you know, that I would say that looks perfect. There's quite a lot that I'm, you know, well, I hate it when I see goalkeepers diving backwards. I hate it because this, you know, you're never surprised when the ball pops back out. We can go on this little bit forever, you know, but and also now I'm seeing a lot of goalkeepers, you know, ending up behind the line in situations when they're under pressure and they're trying to save, not making a real effort to stay in front of that line. You go back behind that line, you know, what's the point of you being there? You're not going to save the ball if you're going behind the line. Remember the goal Meslier the other day? Yeah, when he's diving backwards behind the line and thinking, well, you're not going to save it from there. You know, there's not such an effort to steer forward and anyway, I can go on about that forever anyway. but with Ali, you know, he's a little bit like that. his technique is that he slightly leans backwards when he takes the ball. At first, I kind of sort of wrestled myself. Do I need to change that? Do I need to, you know, try and do it every day so that, to make sure that he doesn't do that? But nothing, you know, he never suffered because of it. The ball always stuck. So it was kind of like, well, why do I change it? And then later on, as we developed our relationship, I remember seeing a lot of times that when he was saving balls that were behind him, and I was thinking, he's saving them. You know, especially like in top corners, because he was going backwards, it was giving that little extra seconds to go to actually get something on the ball. You know, if he'd been going forward, he mightn't get a touch on it. So he was actually making saves that he probably wouldn't make. So then why would I change that? When we're talking about balance and things like that, it's about what's required from the goalkeeper, what's required in the game that's coming up, and only changing things if they affect them. And of course, it's still about improving them and giving them knowledge as well. But it's not about, for me, it's not about telling them what to do. A lot of it is about, you know, trying to put them in situations where they can see themselves what they're doing, so that when we look at the analysis afterwards, it's clear what they're doing, and then they can tell me what they're doing wrong.
Which makes sense, because it's ultimately you want them to be as knowledgeable about the position themselves. You want to educate them so that actually it isn't just you kind of giving them the answer each time, because I guess then they're not necessarily learning as to what they need to learn. I think the other bit that I really picked up on in terms of what you just said there, which is always huge for me, is that you are working according to the goalkeeper. You know, it's not one size fits all. Like, you might have an idea of, you know, we talk often on this show about if you were to build the perfect goalkeeper, you know, what techniques you'd want from each goalkeeper from around the world to build the perfect goalkeeper. Of course, that would be fantastic. But often it's more so it's about being the effective goalkeeper, isn't it? It's finding things that if they are working, they might not necessarily be the prettiest things. They might not be textbook, but if they're working for an individual, then exactly as you said, why would you change that?
Yeah, and for me, it's what's really huge is the mentality of the goalkeepers, and not just about how they approach the game, and you know, like from a sports psychology point of view, but it's about their connection with the game and their emotional state during the game. And I know the way that I was, and for a long time, I thought that being really uptight, really sort of aggressive, really sort of driven, you know, being this sort of like trying to be an authority on the pitch, and I was really angry. It was to my detriment, because a lot of the times, you know, when I was thinking it was helping me, it was probably just a distraction. It was making me make bad decisions. And for me now, looking back and thinking, well, you know, go back that word balance. You need to have a balanced mentality when you're in goal. You know, the calmer the mind, the clearer the thoughts, the better the decisions. A lot of that is around, we talked about goalkeepers make mistakes before. I'm big on not making a great deal of mistakes. Fortunate with Ali, that's Sixton and Andrew have both played for first team games for the last couple of seasons. We're quite fortunate that, you know, there's been some big errors, but like I said, I don't make a big deal of them. And even if, you know, if they make a couple of mistakes, same, of course we go back and we try and correct it and we try and learn from it. But it's not to make a big deal. I think that's a big part of it. And I think that I wasn't really going to talk about this, but over the past year, we've introduced meditation into our routine. We had a teacher come in who's a guy, Ruben Sanchez, who's, yeah, he's actually worked with Oprah Winfrey, New York Yankees, Borussia Dortmund. And he comes in and he teaches a transcendental meditation. There's a lot of fuss about, you know, the organisation, whether it's a religion, whether it's a cult, blah, blah, blah. We had a lot of that in the press saying it was a cult. And the club, this was one of the headlines in the season, that the club was being driven by a cult. There's a guy coming in teaching meditation. And he's trying to put structure in the way that we work. And it was really interesting. And so he came in and taught us meditation. And so it's something that we do before training at the stadium as a group. It's something that the players do afterwards. A lot of them have still taken it up. You know, some people, you know, think it's not for me. But So as from a goalkeeping perspective, I think it's a great idea to have something like that, so that you take the emotion out of it a little bit, so you do make better decisions. And I think it's certainly helped us as well, because it's goalkeeping and sports, multifunctional sports like goalkeeping depend on very good decision making. And I think having a clearer mind can help that. And I think meditation does it.
I think that hits home a lot, really, from a chat we had recently with Carl Hakimi. By the way, I think that's the first time I've ever heard a sentence with Oprah Winfrey, New York Yankees, and Borussia Dortmund.
Well, do you know what? We were very lucky, because he works with all these big organisations and sort of big stars. And Ruben was, I think, the last time, I think he was working with Olympic, one of the Brazilian Olympic teams. And through a former player who's now out in playing at the Far East, he worked with him. So then he was recommended to our club, and he wasn't, you know, he was in between sort of big projects. So he came in for 3 months, and it wasn't just, you know, it wasn't just because of the meditation. Transcendental meditation was at the heart of everything, but he came in and he's kind of like putting a structure in from the manager all the way through the staff, through the assistant, myself, the analyst, the medical staff, sports science. We're, I think there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 of us in the office. So he put in like a structure where everything flowed. The working week flowed. There was a title to the week, and then everything was structured under that. And it was about creating emotional connections to the work. And I know that, you know, working with sports psychology, we worked with Dan Abrahams as well. At I don't know if you had him on the show before, Dan Abrahams.
No, definitely someone we're hoping to.
Yeah, Dan's brilliant, and he came over the first season I was there. And a lot of it is what everyone's searching for in football. You know, we talk about culture. We talk about buy-in. We talk about, you know, game face. Game face was a big thing with Danny Abrahams. And all of this, what we've been doing this year with Transcendental Meditation and sort of like the structures around it that Ruben creates, it's all the same. It's all towards the same goal. Try to build a culture in the team, try to build a connection, an emotional connection to the work and to the game, but in the right way. And I think that's one of the biggest things I've got from working this season.
It's fascinating stuff, this. I reckon we could definitely do this for another few hours, but I know Rich has got his final question coming, David. We haven't really spoken too much about your actual playing career, so similar to the way we do our quickfire three questions, I'm going to just throw out three of the clubs that you played for, and I've picked out an individual from each that you may or may not have a story on. And we'll start with Sunderland. And I looked at some of the goalkeepers that were there at the time. Lionel Perez, did you play with him?
Yes, I did. I did.
What a character.
What was he like?
Well, I mean, initially, I think that season I broke my arm for the second time. I broke the season before when there was a possibility I was starting I think it was the first season that Peter Reid, or his first full season, Peter Reid was taking charge. And I got my arm stood on in training, doing set pieces. We were doing set pieces before the first game again. I think it was Leicester. I got my arm stood on by one of the players, broke my arm. And then it wouldn't heal. So then I was out 5 months, and then I broke my arm the next season. And that's when Lionel he came on trial for a week, and just remembering back, I don't think he actually had the best week as a trialist. But then I was out, and then Tony Cotton broke his leg, and then it was, you know, I think we had to sign him straight away, and he didn't speak a lot of French. he didn't speak a lot of English. So it was difficult to communicate with him. He always seems very aggressive. He always seemed upset about something. But anyway, I just remember we played. It might have been the game when he was chipped by Eric Cantona. Yeah, yeah. So Lionel was playing. I think I'd just come back from the broken arm the second time. So I was sat on the bench. And I was devastated because I think he gave a penalty away in the first half. He brought down Nicky Butt. And he probably should have been sent off. So I was devastated they hadn't been sent off. I'm starting to put my shin pads in. As soon as he goes down, I'm starting to put my shin pads in. Anyway, he only got a yellow card. Yeah, so that was the game that he got chipped by Cantona. And before the game, he was very temperamental, very temperamental. So, like, I'd warm him up before games. So we just started doing a few, like normal, warm up, a few volleys. And I started hitting a few half volleys from the penalty spot at him. And I think two of them weren't straight at him. And he started getting angry. He started throwing the ball back at me hard and started shouting in French. And I'm like, oh, what's going on here? Like, you know, it was only one that was just a side of me. All he had to do was move his feet and catch it. But it wasn't, he wanted everything straight at him. So I did a few more, got it straight at him. And then I sliced another one that went in the net. Took his gloves off, walked in. I'm stood there by myself. I think we were the only two people on the pitch at the time. And I'm stood there in the penalty spot and he just stormed past me into the dressing room. And I was like, oh, God. You know, he was like a big child. And then, I mean, there was nothing to get upset about. I don't know whether it was just because it was, you know, United, there was a lot of pressure, there, you know, a big match nerves. And then it's sort of, he's just blown up. And then that, I think that was the game. Yeah, it was the game that Cantona chipped him, but.
So he's blamed you forever. He's blamed you for the chip, the Cantona chip.
Well, do you know what? Standing that far out of his goal, he deserved to be chipped, didn't he? So he deserved it.
That season then, because that was 96-97, so you must have been there when they were filming the documentary, the Premier Passions documentary.
Yeah, so if you look in the background and a lot of the dressing room situations, especially the home ones, I think it was Aston Villa away as well. Yeah, you can often see me sat in the background just putting my substitutes jacket on. But it was, it was really interesting that because at the time, I mean, it was a bit, I don't think it's like today, you know, you see all this, like the Amazon documentary where they've got cameras everywhere, they've got, you know, hidden away and you can't see anything. This is two guys with a big camera and a big boom stick going everywhere with you, like, you know, and it was a little bit strange. I don't think they were there that long. Maybe it was only half a season, something like that. But yeah, that was really interesting. And it's still even really, really interesting looking back at it. Because I used to love Peter Reid. Absolutely love Peter Reid. You know, he transformed that club. Absolutely transformed the club.
Yeah, great character. And I suppose someone who did the opposite of transforming a club is the next guy, just quickly. Darlington you were at. Did you have any crossover at all with George Reynolds?
Unfortunately, yes, I did. Well, I say it unfortunately. At first, it was a bit of a blessing because it was at a time when we'd flirted with sort of promotion. We were near the top of the league. And then we went to Brentford, who just spent, I think this was in League Two, Brentford had just spent 800 grand on Hrydason from Crystal Palace. 800 grand at that time, like 1998 or something like that. Anyway, so we were going down to that game down in Brentford. We got told we weren't getting paid. Everyone's devastated. We lose the game 3-0 and we sort of slip down out the promotion race. And then towards the end of the season, I'd had a bit of interest. We'd had some bids from, I think, from Charlton and from Bolton that the club had turned down. And the manager turned down just because he thought that at that time, going somewhere third choice wouldn't have been the best move for me. Great. Trusted David Hodgson with my life. I still do now. Still go to him for advice. And anyway, so then he pulled me in the office one day and he says, "We've had another bid." And I think at this point we hadn't been paid for 2 or 3 months, and the club was in real dire financial state. He said, "We've had a bid from Ayr United, and Ayr United was still in the second division in Scotland at the time. We've had a bid of £75,000 from Ayr, and the board is saying they need to accept it to pay people's wages." So it was like, you know, I'm in a tough predicament there, you know, from turning down moves to the Championship and then going to the Championship in Scotland. It was, you know, there's a huge difference in my eyes there. So we're talking about, it says the club's got an option. I think they're going to take the 75 grand. So I'm like, I'm devastated. And then later on that afternoon, got another phone call. All the club's been taken over. You don't have to go. George Reynolds is coming, blah, blah, blah. All this big fanfare. He comes in and then... So it initially saved me, and then going to the next season, so the week before we start the season against Halifax, manager comes in and says, Aberdeen want you, we've accepted a bid, you know, I think it's a great move for you, I think you should go. And I'm like, yeah, but sounds brilliant, blah, 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 go up and see them. So I've went up there, I've agreed the my terms, I've all but signed the contract, but there's the game in 2 days against Celtic, so I need to train. Says, oh, well, I'll train this morning and just get everything over with in the afternoon. Anyway, get a phone call from the secretaries at the club. As I'm going out of training, I've got my boots and my gloves on and everything like that. Somebody comes on with a mobile phone. It's George Reynolds on the phone for you. Says, okay. So picks phone, hello. And he didn't even say hello to me. All he said was, he started off with, have you ever heard the story about the monkey who put his hand inside a milk bottle to get a peanut? And then he did, but what he didn't realise was that he wouldn't be able to get his hand back out of the bottle unless he let go of the peanut. Now I'm so confused at this point. Like, you know, I mean, I don't know what's happening. I said, George, I don't understand. He went, well, he says, all the players at Darling at the time, one of the big sort of incentives for signing for Darling was that David Hodgson was brilliant at bringing players for nothing, selling them on. And so it was always in everyone's contracts. It was, if you got sold on, you would get 15% of the transfer fee from the club. I was like, oh, yeah, brilliant. And I wasn't even thinking about this at the time. You know, I just agreed my terms and everything. I wasn't even thinking about it. He says, I know that you've got 15% of this transfer fee coming to you, which was around, I don't know, £50,000 or something like that, which was, I mean, I was earning sort of like 300 quid at Darlington. You know what I mean? I was 200 quid overdrawn in my bank. Hmm. You know, this would have been like winning the lottery. So he says, unless you sign a piece of paper saying that you don't want this 50, you know, you don't want this 15%, I'll put a block on this move. I'll bring you back to Darlington. You go in the reserves. I'll make the manager play in the reserves. You've got a year left in your contract. You're under 24. You have a year playing the reserves. You can go at the end of the season and let's see who wants you then. Nobody will want you then because you haven't played for a year. No, I'm like, I mean, initially it was just like swear words, keep the money, I don't care, you can have it. And then it went off to training. So it was like, I mean, my first train session, I'm just going into it stunned, like, you know.
Wow.
It's not a great start. But at the time, I mean, all throughout my career, I've never made a decision on money. And it was kind of like, I've never had it. It's not my money. It's something I've never had. I don't care. All I want is this move. Nothing's going to stop me. Keep the money, you know? So that was that.
Yeah, that's kind of the story I think I expected you to say if you had crossed over with him. That is unbelievable. They did a documentary as well, didn't they? And then, yeah, you can see the way he comes across in that. Okay, I've got one more. Aberdeen, I've been waiting since we started this podcast to meet a goalkeeper who played alongside Jim Leighton. Hopefully you are the first, David.
Yeah. And you know what? I mean, I held Jim in such high esteem before I went there as well. You know, at that point, he played in four World Cups for Scotland. Obviously, he'd won all the Cup Winners' Cup and all the Scottish leagues with under Alex Ferguson. And I went there, and I think he must have been 39 when I first went there. And he played the season before, and I think he'd had a cartilage operation, and he wasn't fit yet. And they had a young goalkeeper, Ryan Essen, who they thought wasn't ready. So that was the reason why they came in for me. And you know what? From the first second I walked through the door, he was unbelievable. Unbelievable. So welcoming and giving advice all the time. Even when, you know, I started the season, it was a horrendous start of the season for the team. But he, you know, he would just give me advice, and obviously he'd been through a lot, and that's a big thing for it. You know, he'd been in situations that I was going through. You know, he'd been there. He's probably been, you know, last night I was talking about Alex McCarthy making his career, making a brilliant comeback. I don't think there's a bigger comeback in football than Jim Leighton's, from that, you know, being dropped in that FA Cup final by Sir Alex Ferguson in 1990. You know, he went on loan to Arsenal, played one on the bench there when he was on loan to Sheffield United, played a few games Reading. Then he went back to Scotland, Dundee, Hibs. And from that, it took him 8 years to get from that devastation of being dropped for the FA Cup final replay, being blamed for them not winning the Cup in the first game, for not winning the game. And then all the way back up to facing, I think it was the first game, was against Brazil in the 1998 World Cup. You know, and it's just somebody who I've got, you know, getting to know him as a man, and getting to know his journey and the truth about, you know, what happened behind all that and how he built himself back up again. He didn't become a bad goalkeeper overnight. But I think, you know, you speak to anybody about England who's, you know, about or knows sort of football from the late 80s, early 90s, and you ask about Jim Leighton, the first thing you think of is that World Cup, the FA Cup final, sorry. Mm. And, you know, him being dropped and Les Sealy coming in. But it's a huge story of redemption. That, you know, he goes from that to all that devastation, he works his way all back. And that's another thing, you know, that we suited each other. He became my coach after that, my goalkeeping coach. And he was, I mean, you know, away from the work, you know, he's right up my street. I love to work all the time. You know, if I wanted to have a session before the morning of a match, he'd always be there for me. And he was, and the one thing I got from him as well, he was an unbelievable goalkeeper, even at that age. You know, I got injured after about 14 games that season, and he went on to finish the season. And he actually, because of him, the team got the League Cup final and the Scottish Cup final. Again, you know, go back and talk about techniques. His technique was very, very unorthodox. Very unorthodox. I remember watching him and see a straight volley that was just above his head. He would jump up in the air and catch it. He'd be off the air when he caught it, but he caught it all the time. You know, all of his techniques were very unorthodox, but he was a brilliant, brilliant goalkeeper. Decision making, brilliant, because, you know, he's not a huge man. Didn't really have an athletic build, but he was so effective coming for crosses. He was great. I know, talking to a lot of Aberdeen fans, you know, they criticise him a little bit, but, you know, saying that he was a bit of a line keeper. But that was because he was so good in the line and he was so effective. And like I said, as a man, I couldn't praise him any higher, because, you know, we both went through things in the 6 years that I was Aberdeen, that, you know, from personal points of view, and we were able to lean on each other, and he's somebody who, I have a huge amount of respect for, and just a brilliant, brilliant man. And again, you know, we talk about the emotional side of it, the emotional connection, and he was brilliant from that point of view. He always put perspective on everything that I was thinking. I was always I can be very negative sometimes about games and look at games negatively and be affected by, maybe be affected by mistakes or if I didn't think I was doing things right. But he always gave me perspective and he always brought me back to, you know, this is the way that it really is. And such a brilliant man, absolutely brilliant man.
Fantastic. Well, a nice way to round off the podcast. So, before we get to the final question, just want to give a big thank you myself. I think it's going to be a two-parter, Matt. What do you reckon? I think this is now turned into a two-parter. It's been, and no doubt we could talk for another few hours, I'm sure. But the final question, it's always the same question, David, and that is, David Priest, what has goalkeeping given you?
It's a brilliant question, Matt. I think it's a brilliant question. What goalkeeping and probably football in general has given me is a purpose, genuinely a purpose. Because I want to be a goalkeeper from such an early age, because my father was a goalkeeper in sort of semi-professional level, I just wanted to be like him. And so I'm not one of these keepers who used to play out, who wanted to be a centre forward or whatever. I wanted to be a goalkeeper. And I think because it's been so ingrained in me from an early age that it was probably one of the biggest things that when I stopped playing that I struggled with. Not only being a footballer's an identity, goalkeeping is being an identity. Thinking about the game, analysing the game, it takes up a lot of your thoughts. And when all those are left, then, you know, there's a lot of space there to be filled up by other things. So I think that's one thing that, you know, playing and getting back into coaching and being part of of being part of a goalkeeping sort of community again, you know, it's given me a real purpose, and I'm thankful for that.
David Priest, thank you very much for joining us. Right, where do we start with that one? So much to get into there, and we said afterwards, didn't we, that we probably could have stayed talking for another few hours. There just was not enough time. We could have spoken about all sorts of goalkeeping goodness, but Let's just pluck out some of the best bits, really. The fact that he was a regular writer of his thoughts from a young age, I thought was quite interesting. The fact that he said he really struggled with sleep, which we didn't touch upon at the time. Sometimes we leave things because we think, do you know what, part two, we'll be able to talk to them about this at a later date. But the fact that he struggled with his sleep from an early age and he was a regular writer of his thoughts, it seemed like as well in games that he had to switch himself off because he was so preoccupied with what else was going on the pitch that he couldn't quite focus on the nitty-gritty of being a goalkeeper. So to be so preoccupied with your thoughts, it just felt like he was an individual who has a lot going on in his head.
Yeah, which is somewhere that I'm sure a lot of our listeners can relate, and certainly I can relate, you know. And it's, I suppose, when you're at that level and you have that realization that you need to explore it a little bit more, you know. And certainly I had some similarities when I played, and you come to a realization that if you're not going to find a way to be able to improve the situation on your own, you're going to need to explore other ideas that can help you get there. And you just get the impression that with David Preece, he is somebody who is a student of the game. He will put himself in uncomfortable situations or try and find that information that can take him and now, thankfully, many others to a different level.
And credit to him, because he took himself out of it a little bit. I know that he was involved in various coaching setups, but he took himself away and thought, what do I want to do with my life? And went into journalism for a bit, studied, became a journalist, and was working effectively as a bit part journo just to get his experience interviewing footballers and obviously doing various other bits and pieces that he described in that podcast. But it was great that he effectively had that epiphany that, oh yeah, I should probably write about what I know, cue a career in goalkeeping media.
Yeah, no, it is. It's fascinating. How often do you hear stories like that where what he did, and listening to him, was he was always moving forward. Now, you could argue at one point didn't necessarily know the direction, but by doing the degree in journalism, for instance, is a great example where you gradually keep adding to who you are, and at some point you will find your path. And I'm a huge believer of that, because I've got, again, certain similarities myself, where even this, here you go, we're doing this podcast right now, this wasn't necessarily an idea that long ago. Then all of a sudden certain things happen, certain things fall into place at the right time, and before you know it, you find your path, you find your passion. And certainly with David Preece, that was the case.
He did mention, well, we spoke about the number one podcast as well. I thought it was quite funny when he said, you know, I was there to do the goalkeeping analysis and give all the information. Then we had Lloyd Griffiths, you know, the comedian who added that funny side. I thought, I'm not really doing that on this one. Not sure I'm pulling that off.
We need to substitute you for Lloyd then.
Yeah, maybe get a comedian in. But the fear of failure as well, driving him, that's another great aspect of it, because failure is normally what you say as something not to focus on, but he channeled that fear of failure to actually drive him, to assist him.
Yeah, I wouldn't say necessarily not to focus on. It's an awareness of self. So if you know what drives you, what motivates you, then if you have that awareness, that's a powerful thing, because you'll know what can light that fire within you. Now, I would argue there isn't necessarily a right or wrong motivation. If something's strong enough for you, then run with it by all means. And you will find there are so many people out there. And again, I hate to keep saying I can feel certain similarities, because I had the same thing going on. I think most of us at some point have had that, where it's not necessarily a towards, it's away from. It's a wanting to escape pain in some way. And that might be where you put certain pressures on yourself. But by doing so, there is a secondary gain. And the secondary gain might be that you're having positive performances because you are trying that much harder. You are so driven in what you do. Now, is it enjoyable? Is it always enjoyable? No, of course not. If your drive is a fear of failure, it won't always be enjoyable, but it can be really effective.
And just to finish, you know, he spoke so well throughout that entire podcast, but I did feel that when we got on to his coaching and his philosophy, it kind of came a bit more alive. Really feel like that when you listen back to it. And, you know, he was speaking about the whole diving backwards thing and the fact that he wrestled with that when he was working with Ali Keïta, the goalkeeper at Östersunds. The mentality, the fact that it's not just about a sports psychology perspective, but about their connection with their game, their emotional state with the game. And he spoke about the guy who came in and taught meditation and just developed a working structure with the week. Since he's taken up that role at Östersunds, it feels like he's, I don't know, just advanced as a goalkeeper and as a person.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think as well, if you've got a goalkeeper coach who sees the game in the way that he does, and I think this is, I suppose, a realization for me, but many people listening in, I'm sure, is that goalkeeping isn't as simple as just the technical side of things, even just the mental side of things. Like, there are so many different avenues you can explore to become a better coach. You know, ultimately, you want to make the person you're working with be able to play at the top of their game. You want to offer them every different tool you possibly can. And the truth is, there are thousands of different tools that can help a goalkeeper. Now, of course, you can't focus on all of them at once, and you would overwhelm a goalkeeper in doing so. But the fact that he's had so many different experiences, referential experiences, be able to offer that to those that he works with, I'd have to say they're very lucky.
Richard.
Matthew.
Tack.
What?
I believe that's thank you in Swedish.
Okay, fantastic.
Could be wrong. Google Translate. There you go. This has been the Goalkeepers Union podcast. Keepers.
Away.